Welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios and the EAA Chapter 84 podcast. I'm your host, David Weber. I hope all of you still building are wrenching hard to get that plane in the air before our summer flying season starts, or you've been able to take advantage of the few days we've had around the Pacific Northwest to get some flying in. In this month's chapter podcast, we are going to take things in a slightly different direction, and that direction may change course a few times during our time together today. This month, our podcast is not only going to focus on the history of our guests, but we are going to focus on a few other subjects in aviation, and that will include the world of aircraft maintenance technician, or as most of you know it, A&P. In studio this week, I am joined by two other A&Ps, Shay Moan and Pat Murphy. Shay is currently an instructor at the Everett Community College Aircraft Maintenance Technician School, and Pat is recently retired from there. We are going to get into a little history on both Shay and Pat, where their aviation passion started, and what paths they took to fulfill those passions. Then we will get into some roundtable discussions on what are some areas where aircraft maintenance can be improved, common oversights, serious concerns, and we finish off where builders and pilots can get more and better information regarding the maintenance of their aircraft. The podcast wraps up as I bring you the latest Chapter 84 news, including updates on meetings and events. Please, if you're enjoying these podcasts, I would encourage you to subscribe to EA Chapter 84 podcast, not just so that it helps promote the show, but so that you will know when a new podcast is available. We'll be right back after a quick break. Well, welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios, and today in studio, I have two guests, both A&Ps. We have Pat Murphy and Shay Moan. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello.
Let's start off with Pat first. Pat, kind of give us a little bit of background, where you grew up and kind of how you got involved in aviation and anything exciting about your historical life here.
Well, my parents moved to Alaska before my first birthday. Dad learned to fly up there, and the first airplane that he had was an Aronca Chief, two placed side by side. And being small enough, I could ride in the hammock baggage compartment that was behind the seat. And he had the next plane he had after that was a PA-12, a Super Cruiser. One up front, two in the back. So Mom and I could actually sit in seats, which was nice. But that one got left on the top of a mountain.
Now, would he let you fly that every so often?
No, actually not from the back seat.
Oh, okay. So you're in the back seat.
Yeah, I'm in the back seat. But we were coming back late, and he didn't know exactly where he was. He was where he thought he was. But anyway, he landed on top of this mountain and took off the left landing gear, and that was the end of our trip. But anyway, then after that, he got a Piper Pacer, and then the last airplane he had was a Tri-Pacer.
Now, this was all up in Alaska.
This was all up in Alaska.
And how old were you at this time?
I was 10.
Okay.
You know, young enough to, this was...
And you're 32 now, so this was back in...
The 50s, yes. And when Dad was flying, I remember him flying the four-course range. A lot of pilots don't have any idea what a four-course range is, but this was before...
Explain what a four-course range is.
ADF.
Okay.
And if you were on the range, you heard a solid tone. If you were one side, you heard a dit-da. On the other side, you heard a da-dit. And that was... the long and the short of four-course range.
So this was GPS back in the day.
This was before Loran.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was very, you know, the big peanut-shaped device on top of the aircraft, mm-hmm. that was the receiving antenna.
Great.
And, but anyway, left Alaska, and I've always loved fixing things, always been around. And I liked airplanes because airplanes were cleaner than cars. And so
Now, what do you mean by that? They were cleaner.
Well,
that's a very specific word. So
yes. Well, I was always helping Dad work on our 56 Nash Rambler, pink and gray, by the way. And it was always, when we ever worked on the engine, it was always dirty and greasy and grimy. And I didn't care for that. I wanted to work on something where I could stand up. I didn't have to crawl underneath it. And working on something that there was a lot more respect for.
Okay.
You know, with the car, if it ran, you went with it. If it didn't run, well, you hitched a ride home and got somebody to help you fix it. You can't do that with the airplanes.
Yeah, can't exactly tow an airplane home, can you?
No. There are stories about that happening. But anyway, and so down in Riverside.
So you moved from Alaska to Riverside?
To California.
Okay.
And my dad was going to dental school, and so I mowed lawns for spending money, and then I would drive out to Flaybop, which is in the town of Rubidoux, and I would take flying lessons. I would earn money for mowing lawns, and then I would go out and take a flying lesson. And back then I could get a 150 for $8 an hour wet. The instructor was six, and it was just incredible. But, you know, I learned to fly there, soloed there, and didn't finally get my private license till after I got my A&P license. My parents wanted me to go directly to college out of high school, and I really wanted my A&P license. That's what I really wanted.
So you just knew it?
I had to fix things. I had to work on things.
Right.
And so rather than going to college, well, A&P school was college, I went to Northrop Institute of Technology, or Aeronautics. It's now owned by Rice Aviation in Inglewood, California, right under the approach to LAX,
okay.
The short runway to LAX. And that's where they landed, took the first 747. The city of Everett flew over the dormitory there. And I remember seeing that flyover for the first time. And compare that to an 07 or a Dash 8, I mean, that 47 was just massive.
Oh, yeah.
It was just huge and massive. And we were right off the end of the short runway, which was built for the heavies. And anyway, I got my A&P license in October of 1970. And in December of 1970, I took my private pilot check ride. December 24, 1970. That was a fun trip. And they asked me if I saw any little guys, jolly guys in sleighs as I was doing my check ride. Well, I didn't, but it was a low ceiling, so we couldn't go up and do a whole lot of high work and stuff like that. It was fine. I forgot to push the carb heat in on takeoff, and I very nonchalantly pushed the carb heat in, and that little O200 kind of woke up.
Yeah, yeah.
But
you were probably saying to yourself, where's all my power?
Exactly. Right? oh, there it is. And I was hoping that the examiner didn't see it. But I wanted to fly, do mission flying. My eyesight was always bad. And I could never pass a second class medical. So I went into the full-time as an aircraft mechanic. And while at college, I worked at the airport there, worked for a guy by the name of Fred Frakes, and he was putting PT-6s on Grumman Mallards. And it made it a beautiful airplane. And that was the biggest, at that time, I worked on. We also worked on, other aircraft there, Ronca Chiefs, Champs, Stinsons, things of that type. But that was where I was really starting to get my hands into the bare bones of aviation.
So now what happened after this? How did you end up here?
Well, there was a lot of history going on in there, but...
Because I know that you told me earlier that you were at the school, at the Edmonds Community College Aviation Maintenance Technology
Everett
School.
Everett Community College.
Everett Community College, sorry. And you were there for 32 years?
31 years.
31 years.
I started up here in 1984. And I had been teaching at Lane Community College before that. Once again, teaching aircraft mechanics. I had been hired. I was living in PA at the time, Pennsylvania at the time. And I'm a West Coast guy. And I just had to get back to the West Coast. And so working at Lane was my step from Pittsburgh back to the West Coast.
Okay.
And then I was only hired for a two-year contract. At the end of the two-year contract, Lane didn't get the Saudi contract again, so I was let go. And so I started looking high and low for jobs, and I found this teaching position up here at Everett Community College. And I came up here, and I've been teaching here ever since. But at the same time, I've also kept my A&P and my IA current by doing annuals for, mm-hmm. for other people, 172s, Super Cubs, 182s, you know, generally the 100 series aircraft.
Okay.
And
you're still doing that today?
And I'm still doing that today.
Great.
I'm also the chief inspector for a small repair station here at Painfield. So that helps to keep both my IA and my A&P current. Because I'm releasing parts that we have worked on or repaired back to service.
Okay.
And so it requires an 8130. If people don't know what an 8130 is, it's a yellow tag. You've all seen the yellow tag. Okay, that's it. The actual form is 8130. And it doesn't have to be yellow. It can be on white paper. It says 8130 on it there.
So now you've recently, well, what, 5 years ago, 7 years ago?
7 years ago.
7 years ago, retired from the school.
I retired from Everett Community College. And I did a short contract teaching stint down in Sumner, Washington for Composite Solutions. They are a composite manufacturing facility.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing that I did before I left Everett was I set them up with a composite program that they could incorporate that into their A&P. Because
okay.
the FAA still hasn't really brought in all of what you can do in composites into the A&P curriculum. And then after that, I set up a standalone composite program with all of the 87 being built, as well as all of the composite work going on up at Arlington. I built a standalone composite program. And that was composite manufacturing and repair, teaching students how to do a taper sand on a repair, how to vacuum bag that down, and then go through the processes of the ramp up to cure, and then the ramp down, disassemble it, and then do an NDI test to find out if there's been any problems in this type of repair.
Wow, that sounds like something that I would really like to see you give a demonstration sometime to the membership. That would be awesome. That would be absolutely incredible.
Composite repair is a lot of fun. And the biggest thing I see there is when I talk composites, people want me to equate a composite material to a piece of steel. And you can't do it.
Yeah.
Because in steel, the shear strength is basically the same irregardless of which way you pull. But yet on composites, the shear strength or the tensile strength of that material is based on the layout yeah. of the fibers that are put into it. And so the engineering going into the fiber layout of the material is very involved. It's you just don't throw a bunch of stuff down, glue it up, and vacuum bag it, and away it goes. I mean, the layout is very, very technical.
Wow. I still would love to see you do something like that with the chapter memberships to do that. Well, hey, thanks, Pat. Let's kind of turn our attention towards Shay now. Shay, kind of give our listeners here a little history about you, where you got your start, where you grew up, and how you got into aviation.
Well, thank you, David. So I grew up in Pennsylvania, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in fact. Yes, right across the river from Three Mile Island. In fact, I was there during the unpleasantness in 1979. About 3 hours south of Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, where the Piper factory used to be. So I remember as a very small kid going to the State Museum in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and there's this neat yellow airplane hanging from the ceiling. And you could not get me to go anywhere else in that museum until we had gone upstairs to the second floor, I think, and looked at that yellow Piper Cub. So I just
gorgeous airplane.
That's one of my dream airplanes, and hopefully I'll get to fly one this year. That's kind of a goal. But I am third generation aircraft mechanic.
Wow.
My grandfather on my mother's side was a armorer in the Air Force, and he loaded everything from 762 on the AC-47 Spooky aircraft in Vietnam up to nukes on B-47s, B-52s, and B-58s. And then he retired from the Air Force. And my dad was also in the Air Force. He worked F-105s in what he calls the Great Unpleasantness in Southeast Asia. So he was a crew chief.
Oh, I heard that was a vacation over there.
Well, some of the stories he tells and some of the stories that he still won't tell me. So I grew up, and when he came back, he met my mom.
And was this all in this area here?
So this is all in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
He was kind of, I mean, obviously not Thailand, but he was
right.
Came back to Pennsylvania. Got a job working on helicopters with the Army. So he was rebuilding helicopters that were coming back from Southeast Asia. And
was he still in the Army at this time, or was this
so now he's a civilian contractor?
Okay.
So he's left the Air Force. He's a civilian contractor working for the U.S. Army at New Cumberland. When they moved the helicopters from New Cumberland to Corpus Christi, he worked for the Navy and provisioned naval ships and Marines. And so he jokingly says that he's worked for all of the armed services.
Was there ever a take your son to work day?
There was not. They used to have they used to have open house days. So the three.
So at least you got to go see this stuff.
He would take me over and show me. It's like, yeah, I was working on this helicopter. And so that was kind of cool. So just like Pat had said, with his parents saying, you've got to go to college out of high school. My parents said, you've got to go to college out of high school. So I went to college out of high school. And if you're going to go big. And I went for Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Florida. I had got a 3-year Air Force scholarship to do computer engineering. And I found out in the first year that I enjoyed partying and going out a lot more than I liked computer engineering. And so I ended up blowing the scholarship. Well, I'd always wanted to be a pilot, and I loved airplanes because just been around them.
Right.
My dad built models, and my grandfather had models of the airplanes, and I wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to be a pilot, so I took this as a sign from above, go be a pilot. So I went and I joined the Embry-Riddle program to get my private pilot certificate, and I got my medical, and it said not valid for night flight. And I went, oh, they're never going to hire me as a pilot, commercial pilot.
Was it color blindness?
So I'm color. I've got weird color blindness. I have hard time seeing the lights. I can tell a fire extinguisher is green, but oh wait, no, that's not right.
Your world they're green.
In my world they're still red. It's the oxygen bottles that are weird. So that kind of ended my bid to go be a commercial pilot. And my girlfriend's father, who's now my father-in-law, said, well, you've been working on cars and you've got that mechanical knack, so why don't you go be an A&P? So instead of my first choice of what I have to do, it ends up being my fallback position. It's like I spent a lot of money at this college and I need to do something. So I ended up going and get my A&P at Embry-Riddle, which was a great choice, in my opinion. I think I learned an awful lot there.
Well, hearing you talk about it, I could just tell the excitement in your voice when you talk about doing that kind of stuff. So you must enjoy it.
The best thing about Embry-Riddle was one night there was this girl handing out candy bars in front of the dorms. And I sat down and we got to talking. And here we are almost 30 years later.
Oh, my gosh.
I met my future wife like the second day.
What was she doing there?
So she's a pilot. Oh. She's not colorblind. And we'll get to that. That's actually how I ended up out here. So she is a pilot. She's a commercial pilot and currently flies for Alaska Airlines.
Oh, awesome.
So you're going to see this interaction between what she does and what I do through the rest of this story about how I ended up out here and the certificates and everything.
Is she flying left seat?
She's right seat. So she's first officer.
Okay.
And not quite ready to upgrade yet because the lines are not that good for where she would sit as a captain.
Yeah.
But eventually. My nephew
flies right seat for Alaska as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
And great. So it's exciting to have people in the family that are flying.
Oh yeah.
Of course.
So out of college, I get a interview, and I only say interview in the sense that the representative from Cessna sat down with me and said, "Do you have a pulse?" out of college, I went to Wichita to work on Citation XLs at the Cessna factory.
Oh, okay.
So I was in. There wasn't really a real name for it, but I would call it production test flight, which isn't nearly as exciting as it sounds. We would take the airplanes out of the factory and run them through all of their functional tests and get them ready for their first couple of flights. And right. We would do the first, if we flight sold an airplane, a really good airplane, it took about 3 flights was like the minimum. Because you had to do 1 test flight at full forward CG, 1 test flight at full aft CG, and 1 test flight to make sure that the hydraulics had finally stopped leaking. Because the hydraulic bay on that airplane was just, they never got them tight enough at the factory, and they would wiggle loose on the flights, and so you'd end up just constantly tightening them, wash them down, tighten them, wash them down.
Oh my God. And this was every airplane that was coming off?
Every single airplane that came off the production line would go into what was called green flight.
Yeah.
And the airplanes had no paint on them except primer. That's why they were called green flight, because all the planes were green. They had no interior in them except for the pilot seats and the overhead panel, because it had the WeMax in it, the little Gasper vents.
Oh, okay.
So we had to put that in, and we had to put the seats in. Otherwise, there was no interior in it. There was no seats. There was no carpets. There was just a little bit of sound deadener that was built into the fuselage.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would take them and we would do the first gear swings on them and verify that the gear swing would work. They would test fly the airplanes. They'd have to blow the emergency brakes or blow the emergency gear and the emergency brakes, which were all pressurized nitrogen. So we had to bleed out the system and blow out all the SkyDrol and nitrogen mix. And that really made the hangar a fun place to be. If you've never walked through a cloud of SkyDrol, I highly suggest you don't do it.
Yeah.
It's like just set yourself on fire. I got 1,500 PSI of SkyDrol in the face one day because somebody wasn't watching what they were doing.
It tastes so good, too.
And eyes burn for days. So God. I got a trip to the infirmary. You got to see the wonderful showers there. So my wife was flying for Atlantic Southeast Airlines at the time. She was based in Atlanta. And she was actually my fiance, and then we got married while we were in Wichita. But she was getting sick of the commute between Wichita and Atlanta. So she transferred to Dallas. And so she transferred down there because the commute was going to be shorter between Wichita and Dallas. And she comes home one day and says, "Hey, so my captain knows the manager of maintenance in Dallas, and they're looking for mechanics. And he said, I should take your resume down there and hand it to him." And I said, "Sure, why not?
Why not?"
So 2 weeks later, I'm an airplane down to Dallas for an interview. 2 weeks after that, I'm in a U-Haul truck heading to Dallas with all of the stuff that I, all my earthly, worldly possessions. And which was great because about 2 months after that, I get a phone call from my friend that everybody got a extra special pink Christmas card.
Oh my God.
At Cessna, because this would have been, this was the year after 9/11. So I was in Wichita when 9/11 happened, and I spent the 11th, the 12th, and the 13th sweeping the hangar because we weren't allowed to fly airplanes for 3 days.
Right.
So that was a crazy time. So I end up in Dallas, and Delta goes bankrupt and decides to shut down Dallas. And when they shut down Dallas, they took Atlantic Southeast Airlines, their wholly owned subsidiary, with them. They said, nope, we're going to shut down the base. Everybody's got to leave. So my wife transfers to Atlanta. I transfer to Macon, Georgia. As initially, I was went there as a hangar mechanic. I was working line maintenance in Dallas. Went to hangar maintenance for about 2 months before I got a gig in the training department. And the only reason I didn't go straight to the training department was because they needed me to cover all of the holiday vacations. I got there for Thanksgiving and Christmas. So right after Christmas, I got to go over and work in the training department. So I did that for about a year and a half, teaching familiarization stuff on CRJ 200s, 700s, ATRs. We're getting rid of the Brasilias, so we didn't have to worry about them anymore. It's kind of a shame. I kind of liked working on the Brasilias. They were neat. Wow. Neat little turboprop, little rocket ship looking airplane. But we ended up in Macon, and then I kind of got promoted-ish to maintenance supervisor up in Atlanta. They offered me the job, and I said, yeah. Little did I realize that they would have taken just about anybody at the time because they were so desperate.
Again, do you have a pulse, right?
Yeah, pretty much. So I ended up in Atlanta working as a line maintenance supervisor for about 2 years or so, and then ended up in maintenance control in Atlanta as well, again on the CRJ 200s and 700s and 900s. And then one day my wife comes home and says, hey, because now she's a captain on a CRJ 900. We've got two little ones now at this point in our lives. And she says, hey, I want to go out to Seattle and go to a job fair that they're having, that Alaska Airlines is having. And I said, is it going to get us out of Atlanta? And she said, probably. I said, see you later. So she goes out and goes to the job fair, gets an interview that day, pretty much gets told, yeah, we'll call you in about a week. And we rolled out here. So all the tumblers kind of fit together, moved out here. And while we were trying getting packed up to leave, I got on JS firm and saw that they were looking for an aviation maintenance instructor at Everett Community College. And so right about the time that Pat left, I apparently showed up to.
So was there any crossover there between the two?
Nope.
No,
no, so. he was gone, and I rolled in, and yeah. So I've been working at Everett Community College since September 15, somewhere in there.
Actually, I'd already left the college out here, and I was doing the composite work out at Snohomish.
So there you go.
At that time,
yeah.
So he'd already left our facility here at Payne Field.
Okay.
I was working out there.
And you were out at, you say Snohomish, the Snohomish High School?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We were using the Snohomish High School because they had a facility that would function for composite technology. They had the vacuum system that we could use. They had an oven.
Was this sponsored by the Snohomish School District, or was this just something else?
I'm not sure who put this equipment in initially.
Okay.
But it was there, and Everett Community College needed something along a composite line, and that was the closest place that we could do this.
Because that would be before Amtec, really.
Yep.
Yep, before Amtec, which
Because I designed what went into Amtec.
Yeah. So composites kind of seems to be a growing part of aviation more and more. I know that I had an interview with Bob McDonald quite some time ago, and they were using composites, you know, a lot earlier than I thought that aviation was using composites. Do you see it as something that's just going to continue to grow? Definitely.
I mean, if you look at the 727, about 3% of that aircraft is composite structure.
And now, when you say composites, including everything from fiberglass, to carbon fiber?
There was no carbon fiber back then.
Okay.
We're talking a fiberglass or something along that line, honeycomb, phenolic honeycomb core for flooring.
Okay.
There were a few composite pieces in the flaps on a 2.7, but not a whole lot. And now you look at the 787 and now the 777, the amount of composites in that aircraft is, depending on whether you look at it by weight or by volume, it's between 60 and 80% composite.
And now, is that majority carbon fiber, or is that...
It's a combination of all of the above.
Okay.
But the entire fuselage is almost completely carbon fiber.
On the 8.7.
Yeah, in fact, that is made in a giant roll-type fixture. And they roll that, and then the individual fibers, or the strand fiber, is then rolled onto the structure as the barrel section is rolling.
Now, do they do that at the Everett plant, or where do they do that? Do you know?
That's in South Carolina.
South Carolina?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why they moved everything over to South Carolina, was because the transition would be shorter. Because they took us on a tour for just the instructors. Mm-hmm. We had like a miniature FAM class that Boeing put on through Northrop Rice. And they were talking already at that time, that was almost, it was probably 17 or 18. And they were talking about how Boeing and Everett was just assembling the 787s. They weren't manufacturing, I don't think they were manufacturing any of the pieces, maybe only very few.
Oh, really?
But they were installing them out here.
Actually, Frederickson is where they were doing a lot of that composite manufacturing. Mm-hmm.
So they're still building some of it. But so that's why you see the Dreamlifter in here still every so often.
Because that they're delivering the fuselages.
But when they were in all the time, when they were actually building them, they were bringing the fuselages in from South Carolina. They were bringing the wings in from Italy. They were bringing the tail in from Japan. And they were assembling everything here and then pushing them out the door. But they couldn't build 10s because they couldn't get the fuselage into the Dreamlifter. So they had to build the 10s in South Carolina. And Boeing just said, well, why don't we just build the whole thing in South Carolina?
Right.
So that was one of the reasons why they moved it all the way over there. But one of the biggest problems with composites, and I asked the instructor, I said, so what happens when the airplane's done? You know, when the airplane's done with its passenger life,
right?
What happens to it then? Like Everett Community College has a 727. And that 727 lived its life as a passenger airplane.
Yeah, it has so many cycles before you just have to say. Yeah.
And then it didn't die. The 727 rolled out its life as a passenger airplane, and then it downgraded to FedEx. I want to say downgraded.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It moved over to FedEx.
Right. So it went from passenger to cargo.
To cargo, and they put a great big hole in the side of the airplane, and they put a great big door in there. I said, can you do that with a 787? Can you do that with a composite structure? And he said, no, we can't. It's built that way. We can't cut a hole in it because we can't strengthen the structure to carry the loads once the hole's in it.
Yeah.
And I said, so what are you going to do with it? And they're like, we don't know.
One of the problems with an aluminum aircraft is they can measure the stretch of the aluminum.
Right.
And so they know that after so many cycles that it has stretched so long or so much and that it is beyond its safe life limit.
Well, doesn't Boeing have a big tank out here at Everett that does this?
The problem with composites is it doesn't stretch.
It's just there.
It's just there. Mm-hmm. And it may stretch 1 or 2%, but they won't know what its failure point is.
So that's still an unknown to this day?
My composite teacher in A&P school, who was way more into composites than I ever want to be, said that he watched a demonstration one time of a built-up wing spar section that they just built for testing purposes. And he said that they had the thing in a jig that held one part of it steady and moved the other part of it up.
Right.
So the whole thing started to bend like a half of a U shape.
So probably the root of the wing is is held fixed.
It held fixed.
And then the wingtip, they're bending up.
Was bent up. He said it got about 15 to 20 feet of flex.
Yeah,
I believe it. All of a sudden, it was like a bomb went off.
Yeah.
And the wing spar snapped. And the part that had been elevated came straight up. And when they brought the lift back down again, about 3 inches had just disappeared into dust. So unlike aluminum, where if you stretch it to that point, it'll go crunch and then come back down again and give you something, the composite just disappeared off into the
One of the things that labs do when testing material that comes in is they have to go through the whole cure process, and then they create a coupon that they put in a tensile test machine.
Okay.
And they have to do a high-speed video of it, because when carbon fiber fails, there is a rebound. And sometimes the damage from that rebound creates additional damage that can't be part of the final test. And so they have to see where it broke.
Right.
And then if there's any rebound, okay, we discard that, but we want to look to see where it actually failed. And if you watch something like that fail, I mean, the pressures are going up and up and up, but it's not elongating. It's just staying there. And then all of a sudden, bam! And like you said, when that wing fails, I've seen that video.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things about NASCAR. When you see a NASCAR crash or an IndyCar crash, all you see is this great big huge cloud of dust, because they're not making them out of metal anymore. They're making them out of carbon fiber.
So now, do you think that, I'll ask sort of a very loaded question here. Do you think that this introduction and the higher reliance on carbon fiber and composites is a good thing in the aviation industry?
Why is that? One of the things that they're doing to combat some of the problems with carbon fiber and its rigidity and its potential failure if you get a side load on it is that they're making hybrid fabrics. And they will make a hybrid fabric of carbon fiber and Kevlar, or they will make a hybrid fiber of carbon fiber
something just like a standard fiberglass strand.
No. That is all just a decorative. Tungsten.
Oh, wow.
They're using tungsten as to make a hybrid fabric. And a lot of the military jets are using a combination carbon fiber tungsten hybrid fabric.
Why are they doing that? Why are they adding that tungsten in there?
Increased tensile strength.
So it's strictly a tensile strength.
Increased tensile. And the other thing they want to get away from is when you bend carbon fiber too far, or if it takes a side load, it fails. One of the things I would do in my composite class is I would give everybody a piece of fiberglass strand. Say, okay, try and break it. And it didn't take very long, and they can break it.
Mm-hmm.
Give them a piece of Kevlar, they'll never break it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I give them a piece of carbon fiber, and they can pull on it all they want, and they'll never fail it. But yet, if you put just a single overhand knot in the middle of it, you can pull it and it snaps, because that overhand knot is putting a side load on the fiber, and that's what causes it to fail.
Just brittle in that direction.
Basically. Mm. And that's why when you look at woven cloth, whenever you get a composite cloth of any kind, I don't care whether it's glass, carbon fiber, or anything, it should never be folded. It should always come in a roll.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because if you fold it where it's folded, that is a failure point.
Yeah, now you've got fractures in there.
Potential fractures. Yeah. And the weave, the problem with the weave is every time you have an over-under in the weave, that over-under is a failure point.
So how is this better than standard aluminum construction of aircraft?
They don't use basket weave, or they don't use plain weave fabric.
Well, so I guess... in a more general sense of the word, the reason why it's so popular in aviation today, the reason why most of the airliners are going to it, why Boeing went all in on the 787, is longevity, believe it or not. With a 767, for example, that aircraft is going to fly for so long, it's going to go into D-check. The entire bottom of that airplane is going to be corroded. The aluminum underneath there is going to have all kinds of attack from the outside, from rainwater, from de-icing fluid, from anything else that you're going to find.
So it's not so much a cycle thing, it's more of a duration
thing? It's a duration thing. Coffee. So then on the inside, you've got coffee, you've got various other, you know, the blue water falling down, and all of that settles down to the bottom and causes corrosion, which you don't have to worry about in a composite airplane. So your D-checks are a little bit shorter, they're going to be a little less expensive because you don't have all of the rework of the corrosion going on.
So now do they still have to do this very close inspection of composites for cracks and fatigue, or is that just out the door?
Biggest thing with the composite is, in the factory, if you dropped something, you don't try to grab it. You watch where it goes, and then you either send somebody down there or you yourself go down and you circle what the area where it hit. Because fractures or failures of that type is depends on the speed at which it hit, the angle, and all of these things. And they can map out the fracture radius and the fracture lines from that impact.
And so this is a composite, or is this aluminum that you're talking?
Composite.
Okay.
Because I've never, ever had to call anybody to go find, look at where I dropped a tool in my airplane. But all my airplanes have been metal.
And, right.
So I like the metal airplanes.
Much more ductile.
I want to stick with metal airplanes, but the composites. Well, it's such a young technology as well.
Do you see it migrating into more general aviation? Do you see?
I don't know. Is it still too
immature for that yet?
When I hear horror stories about, it was a Cessna, that new one, the one that they got from
the Skycatcher,
not the Skycatcher.
Oh, the 400.
That the 400.
The Columbia.
It was the Columbia.
Yeah.
I heard a horror story that somebody had dropped a wrench on the wing. And they had to total the airplane because the wrench
went through or cracked.
It hit it just right that apparently it was not repairable.
And I see that with ultrasonic. You can see those failures ultrasonically.
So it's not a fatigue failure in composites as much as it is an impact failure.
Yeah, they don't like getting hit. And to this day, I don't know how they're going to keep an airplane from getting hit out on the ramp, because it was,
especially when you have Teslas that drive into them.
Yeah, right? That was a good one. And not even Teslas. We've had when I was working in Atlanta, we had a tug. They were pulling an airplane across the runway.
I mean, can you imagine them having to scrap an entire 787 because a tug hits it?
And I could see, because there would be no way to repair it. There'd be no way to fix that fuselage once you put a hole. I mean, we had a hole in the side of that airplane. That was a good 2 feet long by a foot and a half wide. And they came in and they shored it up and they were able to patch it all back up with aluminum. And I don't see how you can do that.
One of the problems that they had with Arab Emirates was they had a coffee pot fire in an early 87. And it destroyed a portion of the barrel section in that area. And so what they actually had to do was Boeing built a barrel section from that station area, and then they were able to cut out from there the pieces that they would need to go in and make a repair along with the doublers that were going to be put on the backside, and then they high-locked it in place. And these, by the way, were titanium high-locks. Either titanium or stainless.
Explain to people what a high-lock is.
It's a bolt on steroids.
It has a stress point where it breaks when you tighten.
And the thing is, high-locks are great. I love them. But the thing is, if you put an aluminum high-lock and carbon fiber, now we have a corrosion issue.
Mm.
So if you use titanium or stainless Hylox, then we don't have a corrosion issue because carbon fiber does conduct electricity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It is a conductor. And aluminum is one of the worst things that you can put next to carbon fiber. But they were able to actually make a barrel section, and then they were able to cut out what they needed for the repair of this barrel on this Arab Emirates 787 and go down there and put it in.
Cool. Well, let's kind of leave composite behind a little bit. I think we've beat that horse to death. Let's get a little bit back more towards general aviation and specifically what our listeners are into, which is building aircraft and usually an experimental type of aircraft. You know, something built in the garage or in a hangar.
Actually, in the living room.
Yeah, in the living room. This is true. This is true. I've done probably close to a 50 or so inspections of aircraft. And for the most part, I would say that builders are very meticulous about what they do. It's their baby, you know. They want to see it built right. But there is a small contingency that seem to want to just slap it together because they think it's a more economical way for them to get into airplane ownership.
To give you a little example of that, the home-built kit that was a composite fuselage, but yet it had metal wings, that aircraft, it was made up here in Arlington. That one's...
The glass air?
No, not the glass air. The glass air was all composite. No, it was the glass star.
Yeah.
There we go, the glass star that had the aluminum wings. I had a student who bought one of those kits, and he took the sheet metal portion from me here at Everett Community College so he could learn how to put rivets in. And this guy, when he first started, he couldn't drill a straight hole for love nor money, and he tried it all. By the time he finished the program, he could drill a whole consecutive row of holes, perfectly aligned, perfectly straight. He could put rivets in all of those holes, and then he could go through and take those rivets out without damaging the metal. Now, this was the level of expertise or experience he wanted so he could build his airplane.
But that was practice. And education and practice.
Education and practice. Okay. I looked at the wings that he built, and they were awesome. I mean, they mm-hmm. were beautiful wings. I mean, he did an awesome job of building those wings. So that's what this home builder went through so he could have the skills to build his airplane. And I wish they would all do some. If they don't know how to do a skill, find somebody who can teach you how to do it.
So that's kind of where I was going with my statement is what do you think are common mistakes builders do and how can we remedy that? What do you think that as A&Ps, people that are involved with, you know, building or working on aircraft day to day, what can we do to kind of educate the guy that's a software engineer and, you know, has done very little drilling or deburring of anything in his life?
I think one of the biggest things that would help them immensely is don't be afraid to contact your technical counselor. Don't be afraid to ask. You know, we've got our A&P certificates. We had to demonstrate a certain level of skill in almost all of the structures.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I do at school is I teach a lot of structures. I teach wood structures. I teach sheet metal structures. I'm working on learning how to do dope and fabric. And
you didn't know how to do dope and fabric at Atlanta?
No. And in fact, when I went to Embry-Riddle, the Harvard of the sky, my dope and fabric training was pretty much, this is a piece of fabric. Airplanes were once covered in it.
No.
There's some writing on the back that means something.
The FAA has like, it's a level one. You don't have to do much
to get your A&P. I know it's a level one, but...
But yeah, so... So don't be afraid to reach out and ask. One of the things we do is We mentor other mechanics. When we get the experience, we pass that on. And most of us don't mind passing that experience on to pretty much anybody who'll ask. And then I guess the other thing that I see from the students and my students is the old adage of practice makes perfect. Pat said, don't go attack that wing and start drilling holes in it. Get some sheet metal. And it doesn't even have to be aluminum. You get the cheapest stuff that you can find and learn how to drill a straight hole by hand. That is my we've got all of, there's all of these
crutches. And it's an easily learned skill if you practice and have some good mentorship to do that.
That's it. It's just, it's over and over again.
It just takes time though. I mean, I challenge you on your easily learned skill because I've seen enough people try to drill straight holes.
Maybe the word easily, but it is a learnable skill.
It is a learnable skill.
It is.
And then trying to drive rivets now. Oh, my goodness. Anyway.
Yeah. But I would add, Shay, to that as an AMP, I also feel like if I don't know it, I can at least go find out where it is. And I've got those contacts and those resources to go find out that information. Well, probably a lot easier than most builders.
And that is the typical answer to the FAA too, right? Is I don't know the answer, but I know where to find it.
Right.
And if you're a builder and you don't have a copy of AC4313-1B/2B sitting in your toolbox, I have about four copies laying about the house.
And it's free to download.
Although my students come in with their computer with the AC4313 downloaded on it. And I say, okay, so I'm going to put my book down next to it. And I'm going to hold this cylinder over top. Which one do you want me to drop it on? If you're out in the shop and you're working on things, paper is a lot more easily replaced.
You can tab things. You can make notes in the side.
It's that old school thing.
Reference the 4313 on a 337.
That's a great point.
Well, actually,
because it is an advisory.
No, it's in the 1B, it says that it can be used.
If.
You're still going to have to sell it to the FAA, but you always have to sell it to the FAA.
Exactly.
But you can use it for major repairs now, depending, as long as the FAA will buy off on it.
And it really works if the original manufacturer of the aircraft didn't really give you a service manual on how to fix things anyway.
Yeah, but we're talking home built, so there is
there's
you are the original manufacturer.
That's not a topic for the home builders.
Right.
However, one of the things that for the AMP mechanic, you cannot say that a home built aircraft, an experimental aircraft, is airworthy. You cannot make that statement because there is not a document that says what the aircraft was like when the FAA gave it its airworthiness certificate. And so all an AMP can do is say that it is serviceable for the particular flight. But you cannot use the word airworthy.
Because airworthy design is defined in Part 3 as complying with its type certificate and being safe for flight. So I always catch my students on that too. They always forget the complying with its type certificate or documentation.
Exactly. And so, you know, a lot of guys will get an AMP mechanic and ask him to do the yearly inspection on it. And I've heard from the FAA that they see these coming out with the word, I certify that this aircraft has been inspected and is airworthy. The inspected part is fine. Airworthy is not. You can't say it's airworthy.
So what do they suggest?
Safe for flight.
Safe for flight?
Safe for flight.
Because, I mean, that's just the boilerplate out of 4311. I certify this aircraft.
Right.
Exactly.
In accordance with
you're working on a certificated aircraft there.
So that kind of brings me into another topic I wanted to touch on, which is sort of this misconceptions that we have in aviation and aviation maintenance. You know, you just got done mentioning that you can't deem it airworthy. Yet,
exactly.
I can guarantee you, I can look at a lot of logbooks, and that's what it says. So What other kind of misconceptions do you think that we have as home builders that revolve around, you know, maybe something that has migrated over from the certified end of that?
I think one of the things that the builder of the aircraft needs to know is that he has more knowledge about that aircraft.
That's a great point.
Than the mechanic coming into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is the one who's going to know this aircraft intimately.
Now, I would emphasize the builder.
The builder.
Not yes. the owner, because...
Now, if the builder sells the aircraft,
right.
the person who buys the aircraft cannot do the inspections on that aircraft. He's going to have to contract, go right. back to the builder who built it to do those types of inspections.
And that's the whole basis for why the builder can get the repairman certificate
exactly.
to perform their own inspections and maintenance, because the FAA recognizes
that the heart of that is the 51% rule, right?
So, right. Nobody knows that airplane right. better than the builder.
Yeah.
So the hard part comes in, I would guess, when the airplane gets sold from one coast to the other coast, for example, and now the builder is not going to be available to do any kind of inspection on it, or even have like contact information possibly. And now the mechanic's going to be out there mm-hmm. with the only guidance they have, which is Appendix D of Part 43, and trying to do the best they can with what they have.
So one of the things that I've had discussions with before on other builders is when they get their inspection done by the DAR, and they're always worried that the DAR is going to deem their aircraft unairworthy. Does the DAR have the authority to do that?
Well, they won't grant an airworthiness certificate, because even though this is where the semantics come in,
right.
it's the FAA doing their crazy things, the aircraft isn't technically airworthy, and yet it's still going to get an airworthiness certificate issued to it in the special category of experimental. So if the DAR finds anything they don't like, then they're just not going to issue the certificate until you get it fixed. EAA had a fantastic presentation during Home Builders Week on what the DAR is looking for, with some fantastic examples of things that were right and things that were not so right. And I can't wait to go back and look at watch that video again, because it was so much information. I just couldn't absorb it all at one time. But it's a really good thing, a fantastic resource. And again,
so what kind of things could we kind of tell builders to ease their mind a little bit about that inspection? Is there anything that we could share that would say, hey?
I think what you could do is tell the builder that if you built this exactly as the plans, or for example, I have a set of plans for an Osprey 2.
Okay.
There is still a dream that someday I may have an Osprey 2 in my living room. But there is also a large group of Osprey 2 builders who've come up with a lot of revisions.
Right.
And if you follow those revisions exactly, and then if the DAR is looking at it and says, well, this isn't like the plan. Okay, here's my documentation for why I made this change. For example, the fabric on the wings is not rib stitched, it's glued. But the width of each cap strip on the ribs is a half to three quarters of an inch wide. And so for a smoother effect, there's no rib stitching. It's all glued down. Okay.
Is there approved engineering, approved documentation that the builder could reference for the DAR?
Just from the design of the aircraft.
So would the builder be able to reference like an AC-4313?
Nope.
Not at all.
No, definitely not AC-43. I mean, AC-4313 is going to tell you about PK screws. It's going to tell you about wires. It's going to tell you about all different kinds of other methods of holding the fabric in place. Never is it going to be glued. But yet with the Osprey 2, it's all a glued type of attachment. But here's something that going back to that the home builders should understand is Walt Whitman, when he died in his crash, when he built his airplane, he built into it a flaw 13 years before the aircraft failed. And if he had known how that fabric was going to come apart or what he was building into it, he could have prevented that failure and the death of him and his significant other. So, you know, there's an example of building in a failure that may not happen today, tomorrow. It may not happen for 10 years, but it is still lurking there because something wasn't done quite right. And the fabric ripped off the top of his airplane, blanketed his empennage, and he had no control over the aircraft. So,
but he was an experienced builder too. I mean, designer, builder.
Designer, builder, all of this,
racer.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yet, he didn't get the sequence right for the fabric that was going over the top of his windshield. And the airflow.
Do you think somebody else would have caught that? If somebody else would have inspected that aircraft?
I doubt it.
Okay.
Because the laying down of the fabrics on that is something that he needed to learn before he put the fabric on the aircraft. Hmm. It was that early in the assembly where the mistake was made. And so that's why it's so important to the builders. When you're building something, don't just look at it from a surface. You have to look at it deep down. I mean, okay, so you're drilling a bunch of holes and putting in some rivets. What happens when you get down here to the end and your holes don't line up?
Mm-hmm.
Or something along that line, or you're trying to roll the fabric or the sheet metal over the leading edge and it doesn't go quite right. Okay, how can we go about doing that? Oh, don't just throw it up there and just paint over it. Don't use Bondo to fill in the gaps. one of the
just really lightweight Bondo, right?
Well, actually, Boeing has a Bond. No, they have, seriously, Boeing has a light Bondo.
Oh, yeah. They're out there.
Yep.
But I don't think they call it Bondo.
And then you put micro balloons in it to make it even lighter.
And the problem with that, with an ultrasonic inspection, it looks like a void.
Yep.
Wow.
So, but, you know, there's a lot of little things that they can think they can do this in the RVs.
Mm-hmm.
Guy took and all of the rivets on the top of his spar, on the top of his wing, were gone. I mean, he had a beautifully smooth surface. Well, he had done that with a wide belt sander. He had sanded off all the tops of the rivets down to the skin, and then he'd gone over that with Bondo. And then he sanded it down, and when he painted it, it looked beautifully. But yet, there was no shear strength.
Yeah, the structural integrity of that rivet
was gone.
It's gone, yeah.
So it's just little things like that I was asked to annual a PA-28 one time. And I went up and started looking at the aircraft. I just did a pre-inspection, just view of the aircraft. And I saw all this hardware on the mags and on the back of the engine. And every piece of hardware, there said BAC on there. And I told the guy, I said, I'm sorry. I said, I cannot annual this aircraft. He says, well, the IA before you did. I says, fine, then go get him.
Yeah.
But BAC on hardware is not allowed on an aircraft that has PA in front of it. Piper didn't design their aircraft with Boeing spec hardware. We're not arguing the strength of that hardware. What we're arguing is, technically, that is the wrong fastener for that location. So I know a lot of guys.
And that's
used to
critical in certified world. That is,
yeah, if it's not approved, in the IPC, it's not approved.
Right.
If it's not approved,
IPC
can't have it on
Illustrated
airplane.
Parts catalog.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
but I know a lot of guys used to go down to Boeing surplus. I guess they don't have it quite the way it used to be. But they'd buy
Well, that's part of the reason why they don't have it anymore.
Yeah.
Boeing was looking at the liability of that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, all right, guys. Hey, one other thing I want to touch on before we end up here, which is I love working on airplanes. Obviously, both of you love working on airplanes. I've wanted to work on airplanes since I was a kid, and always tried a way to find a way to work on airplanes and eventually get into a career of that. What kind of advice? Let's start with you, Pat. What kind of advice would you give to young people these days to start looking at that?
First off, I would go out and find somebody that you can tag around for a few days. Or find a mechanic that will allow you to be beside him to watch what you're doing.
Okay.
Get an idea, get a feel for what he's doing. And not just the nice, easy, clean stuff where you're just doing an inspection, but get down there and help him change tires, wheels, and brakes.
Mm-hmm.
Replace the pucks in the master cylinder. Replace the pads on the brakes themselves. Get in there and cut open an oil filter and look for part numbers inside the oil filter. Well, yeah. I'm saying that in jest, but I mean, yeah. If I see part numbers in the oil filter,
it's a bad day.
It's a really bad day. But just, you know, help him do stuff like that. Okay. Watch him clean the spark plugs. Watch what he does when he's cleaning the spark plugs. You know, why is he keeping all that dust? Why does he put a mask on when he does it?
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want to inhale any of what he's cleaning out of the spark plugs. Just things like that. And one of the things I would always tell mechanics who worked for me was, after you finish inspection, you take the airplane out and wash it. Because that way, if he forgot an inspection cover someplace, he is the one who's going to find it. It's not going to be me.
Right.
And it's just little things
so
like
what
that.
You're saying, in essence, excuse me for interrupting, is get involved early.
Get involved.
See what it's all about before you make that leap into actually going to school.
Exactly. And if you're going to go to a school, my suggestion would be a school like Everett Community College or Clover Park, a two-year school. I realize a shorter school can get you in the work field faster.
Mm-hmm.
However, your brain is not going to remember everything you learned in the first 6 months by the time you get out. And so, yes, it may take a little bit longer, but you will retain that information much longer.
And still, don't expect to know it all, even after 2 years of
school. Oh, please
don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't be ashamed to say,
I don't know the answer, but I can find the answer for
you.
Let
me go find out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shay, any advice?
The big thing when you do make that conscious decision to go to the school, one of the things I see a lot of students fail at is taking it as seriously as it needs to be.
Exactly.
You need to look at it
Great point.
I'm going to work for the next 2 years. Even if you have another job, when I went to school, I had two other jobs and I was very active in one of the clubs while I was still putting in 7 or 8 hour long days for the A&P program. You just got to take it as another job. You got to be serious. You got to be there on time. You have to stay for the entire time and you have to apply yourself. It's not any of these college TV or funny movies that you see.
Yeah.
It's serious business.
It is serious business, and don't be ashamed of it. It's a serious career.
Because one of the things that you always hear A&Ps say is, hey, treat that airplane, work on that airplane like you're putting your loved one on it.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I did that for 12 years. Every airplane that I worked on, it was like Russian roulette. My wife was going to be on that airplane, and if I screwed it up, it was going to be a bad thing.
Yeah, if you're watching an airplane taxi out after you got done doing major maintenance on it and you're not worried, you're not a good mechanic.
I worked with a guy that got a phone call in the middle of the night when his airplane that he had worked on the night before crashed. And fortunately, it wasn't his fault. It was a design fault in the engine. But yeah, it's not a pleasant thing. As long as you've got your ducks in a row and as long as you've taken it seriously, you don't need to worry about the FAA. You don't need to worry about taking the tests. You put your mind to it, and you will be surprised how much more you remember when you put your mind to it. as opposed to, oh, well, I'll just go in and I'll just spend the day in lab and I'll get done. No, you're a much, much better mechanic, and you've got a much better earning potential when you come out of the school with a good grasp of the information.
One of the things I would tell the students when I was demonstrating something, I says, now, this is the way that I have found that this particular skill works best. Now, you may find a different way to do it that works for you. But right now, do it my way. And once you have figured out how to do it my way, then develop your own process. I don't care how you do it. If the end result is the same, if the end result is still an airworthy project and it goes out the door, I'm happy with that. But just remember, what goes out the door flies.
Right.
Yeah, there's no second chance. If you get a second chance, it's a blessing.
Yep. Do you think pride in your work has anything to do with that?
Absolutely.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, if you're not proud of the airplane, that even if it's a piece of junk, even if you hated it all night long and you're wrestling with it and you're fighting with it, when it goes out of the hangar, part of you goes, oh, thank goodness that's done. But part of you says it's better than it was when it came in because of what I did. And that airplane will be safe, and it'll get it. I'll see it again tonight.
Yeah, and then I bring that up because one of the things that I personally find somewhat, I hesitate to use this word, but offensive, is that people say, "Oh, you're just an A&P," and I'm sorry, but that A&P has lives on their hands. I mean, you see six people get in an airplane that you just got done changing a cylinder out.
Well, let's put it this way. It takes, 1,500 hours for a commercial pilot to sit right seat in a regional aircraft or any aircraft now to go fly. It takes 2,000 hours in person, face-to-face learning to get your A&P.
Yeah. In an approved school.
Part 147 school.
I mean, 3,000 if you're doing it out in the field.
Yep, we take it seriously and
very seriously. And if you screw it up and if I don't like it, I'm sorry. I have my license. You don't have yours, so do it my way.
Hey, gentlemen, thank you for coming down and spending time with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
This
for
has
us.
Been absolutely wonderful. And I'm going to put you on the spot here, but at some point in the near future, I'd like to see the three of us and maybe anybody else that's got some A&P skills to kind of put on a little clinic for the chapter members, thinking like, let's start off with something basic, like how to borescope a cylinder or something like that. Can I get you guys to commit to something like that?
I'll be more than happy to show up.
Well, there
especially
you go.
Borescoping, you know, looking at an exhaust valve. What do you see on an exhaust valve? And what are the precursors to an exhaust valve failure?
I think that would be a great clinic for our members.
Like I say, have tungsten bucking bar. We'll travel.
All right. Thanks for coming down to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios. And I hope to see you soon. Thanks, guys.
And now, chapter news for May 2022. This month's meeting will be held on May 10th, 7 p.m. at Harvey Field in Hangar 15. Chapter leaders are continuing to encourage members to show up in person. We had a great turnout with over 30 members at the April meeting, so come on out and join us in person at Harvey Field. Our traditional burger burn will continue in May, starting around 5:30. Get there early, as the burger cleanup starts well before the meeting, and we don't want you to go hungry. If you are interested in helping with the Burger Burn event, just show up and start helping. There is always plenty to do, with whether it's burger flipping or just picking up the mess. The presentation in May will be by Stephen Tibbetts, the founder and CEO of the eVTOL aircraft company, Ziva. Ziva was founded in 2017 to compete in the Boeing Go Fly competition. Stephen Tibbetts, as a serial entrepreneur, saw a business opportunity and has built a company on the back of that effort. Today, Ziva has a team close to 25 engineers and designers with a goal to bring eVTOL to the market for personal transportation, first responders, and many other applications. The Ziva aircraft, called Zero, has many unique features that set it apart from the competition, but the most unique is the round wing concept. You can get more information about Ziva at zivaaero.com, or better yet, come to the chapter meeting with your questions for Stephen. Are you interested in camping at Oshkosh this year? Jim McGoy is organizing a chapter campout where members can pitch a tent and meet up with other members. There is a limited number of spots left, so get in on this before it's too late. If interested, contact Jim at secretary@eaa84.org. If you haven't heard about the Red Bull pilot transfer stunt yet, then you have been living a very sheltered aviation life. On April 24th, two pilots attempted what could be called nothing else but a stunt in the Arizona desert skies. This involved two highly modified Cessna 182 aircraft beginning a nosedive at 14,000 feet, and then both pilots exiting their aircraft in an attempt to, while in freefall, catch up to and board the opposite aircraft. The stunt was only partially successful, with only one skydiver boarding the aircraft while the other Cessna entered an inverted flat spin, making it impossible to safely board. While Red Bull claims all safety issues were addressed prior to the flight, the FAA was not happy with the proposal and denied the team approval for the stunt, citing in the denial letter that granting an exemption from 91.105A would not be in the public interest, and the FAA could not find the proposed operation would not adversely affect safety. The letter went on to address other regulations that would be violated if the stunt were to take place, including the lack of public interest, meaning the stunt did not advance the interests of the aviation community. After the stunt attempt, the FAA announced an investigation into the affair and stated a preliminary report should be available within weeks. All this aviation drama was on the heels of the FAA not just suspending, but revoking Trevor Jacobs' pilot's license after he jumped out of a plane which appeared to have been nothing but a YouTube stunt. I'd like to take a moment to remind my listeners that as pilots in the U.S., we have unprecedented privileges that are just not found in the rest of the world. And with those freedoms comes the responsibility to care for those privileges. Be careful up there, please. Hey, some exciting news in the chapter. We are adding a significant tool to our chapter tool crib. The chapter has purchased a Bailey 40-inch 3-in-1 combination sheet metal shear, brake, and roll. This is a very nice unit, and we hope it will come in handy for those large sheet metal tasks that come up every so often in your aircraft build. The final rules on use on the new tool have yet to be finalized by the board, but that should be coming very soon. And one final note, last month I asked you to honor Bob McDonald by listening to his podcast interview, and wow, was the response big. Bob's interview is now the most listened to podcast out of all the episodes. Once again, Bob never fails to impress. If you haven't listened to Bob's interview, and if you're interested in hearing about Bob's amazing life, please go listen to episode 5 of the EA Chapter 84 podcast. If you've already done so, I would encourage you to listen to a few other interviews like Hank Schilling in episode 3 or episode 4 with Arnold Ebnetter. You won't regret a minute of it. Well, that wraps it up for this month's podcast. I want to thank all of you for your support. Spread the word about EA Chapter 84 podcast to your aviation friends and family. It's available for download on most popular apps, including Spotify, Apple, and Google. Make sure to hit that like button, subscribe, and give us a 5-star review. I hope you remember to file a flight plan for next month's podcast. Be sure to find the latest news by following EA Chapter 84 on social media apps like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, this has been your host, David Weber, and remember, stay off the brakes, keep moving forward.